rise of Neoplatonism in North Africa, Greece, and Rome corresponded to a situation existing at that time which has interesting psychological parallels with the present state of our culture. Recognizing that the first 5 centuries A.D. brought with them the greatest upheaval the ancient world had ever known, it is easy to understand why, under the pressure of these stressful centuries, men began to reevaluate their spiritual heritage. We recognize the gradual crumbling of the Roman Empire. The most powerful cultural unit that had arisen up to that time. We know that the glory of Greece, which was largely its intellectual and aesthetic glory, this glory had declined, leaving one of the proudest civilizations that we know naked to its enemies, the Romans. We also realize that the great dynastic structure of Egypt had collapsed, first under Greek pharaohs and later under Roman governors. Egypt had lost its leadership in the religious and scientific worlds where it had long been preeminent. All of these heavy circumstances made it inevitable that the average human being should find himself confused, broken away from his old footings and foundations, apparently deserted by his gods, a prey to the selfishness and barbarism of his contemporaries, and with very little refuge against the tremendous storm that was rising in the Mediterranean area. We are much in this condition today, so far as the bankruptcy of our foundation concepts is concerned. Today, the average person is drifting, whether he realizes it or not, into a rather dangerous skepticism, a skepticism which he seeks to sustain with scientific concepts. Actually, this skepticism, passing generally for a kindly humanism, is attempting to give us certain substitutes for an essential culture. These substitutes are rugged individualism, the rights of man to hew his own destiny out of the mysterious basic materials of space, the idea that each individual must stand alone and must find such consolation as he can in the fulfillment of the life he sees and experiences every day. The drift away from abstraction, from philosophical overtones, this drift is obvious to us all, and it is being intensified by our educational, our scientific, and our economic pressures. In these days, therefore, as Dr. Troynbey has so well pointed out, there is an inevitable division among persons and groups. The larger majority will drift with the prevailing pressures of the time, fighting somewhat, but feebly, against any strong current that would sweep them along. At the same time, there is a minority that, recognizing the essential danger of the time, a danger which success and prosperity and world power cannot conceal from us, recognizing this danger, there are some who are seeking to restore an adequate concept of life. And here, in this case also, we are very close to the Neoplatonists, working with the problem that they faced. They realize certain basic weaknesses in the spiritual leadership of religion. We have also recognized these weaknesses. We have fought for a long time against what might be termed religious literalism. That is, the acceptance of religious tradition, historical or mythological, as the foundation of spiritual security. The Greeks and the Neoplatonists, looking back upon the great concepts of Greco-Roman religion, found also that their security as individuals was threatened by an inadequate interpretation of spiritual doctrine. So today we are attempting, more or less progressively, to separate religion from the superstitions that have developed around it. But we do not wish to follow the attitude of the materialistic humanist who feels it is perfectly justifiable to burn down the church to get rid of the rat in the basement. We do not wish to destroy religion in order to save it. We do not wish to take an extreme attitude of casting away all because part is no longer useful. We know that to do this we offend many. That if we turn against religion, we turn against a strong and necessary force operating in the lives of millions of persons. We also realize, whether we like to admit it or not, that we have no ethical substitute, nothing to take the place of religion if we attempt to overthrow its influence. The Neoplatonists felt the same. They realized that their problem was not to destroy religion. Their problem was to rescue religion from the irreligious factors that had crept into its own structure. The first point that they attack, and to a large degree we are focusing attention upon the same basic problem, is what might be termed dogmatic interpretation. They realized that religion was simply more than obeying, more than accepting, more than affirming that a man was good merely because he accepted a prevailing doctrine. Therefore, that the dogmatic use of religious instruments is essentially wrong. The individual should not assume or believe that virtue can be thrust upon him, or that the state of grace can descend upon him merely as the result of obedience to a formula, or to the acceptance or the acceptance of a theological doctrine. Neoplatonism, therefore, recognized the tremendous need for a religious house cleaning, that the purpose was to restore the natural faith of mankind, to recognize that this basic power of faith is one of the most positive and constructive forces, possibly the greatest incentive to essential cultural growth that man has ever possessed. Yet this faith has been exploited, not only intentionally, but unintentionally. It has been subjected to centuries of overlaying with theology and with superstitions and with beliefs that are not an essential part of man's spiritual need. To meet all of these problems, the Alexandrian Neoplatonists sought for what they called a grand key for the restoration of the essential faith of mankind. Many works have been written trying to estimate the effect of Neoplatonism upon its own time and upon subsequent ages. The general consensus of opinion has been that this influence or effect has been tremendous, that it has been far beyond what might be assumed to be reasonable in relation to the comparatively small group of dynamic spirits involved in the school and its comparatively brief existence as an historical entity. Thus, it is assumed, perhaps correctly, that Neoplatonism was the training school of Christian theology, that nearly all of your important founding fathers within Christianity were Neoplatonists, that from the disciplines of this school they began to get an insight into the essential difference between religion, per se, and theology. And in their work, they used the instruments, of course, most naturally available to them. Their background was the great religious systems of Greece and Rome. We have already gone into some detail concerning the interpretation and the story of the Greek theogony, how the tremendous pantheon of divinities came into existence, and how these divinities were thinly veiled embodiments or personifications of universal forces, principles, and laws operating in the universe. These principles were known to some. They were known to Plato. They were known to Pythagoras, and probably to Socrates. They were at least intuitively sensed by Aristotle, although his type of mind was not given as much to abstract speculation as was the mind of Plato. With the exception of a powerful group of leaders, however, it seems that the deeper Orphic significance of religion was not too well known to the Grecians. They apperceived to a degree. They were initiated in certain rites. They sensed, as we sense, the sublime theology which rested beneath the surface of their fables. But as we have not been able, in 1950 or more years, to grasp the mystical, hyperphysical overtone of Christian revelation, so they were not able to grasp fully the deeper and more moving parts of the Orphic theology. Thus today, modern Christendom, influencing the spiritual destiny of at least a quarter of the population of the earth, is still not able, actually, to put into operation the essential parts of its own teachings. This was true of the Greek religion in general. Christianity looks back upon a small group of illumined mystics, an idealist and dynamic human beings who took their faith and accomplished wonders even unto miracles. But this tremendous dynamic has not been generally conveyed to the world. It is not available in the life of the average person as a means of strengthening him against the various weaknesses and intemperances which affect our society. Thus, while we have in Christianity a wonderful metaphysics, we have a tremendous mystical theology. This, while acknowledged, while sensed, while portrayed to us in the great art of Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, these great visionary values have never been able to move masses. They have never been immediately available to the individual in his hour of trouble. This does not mean that Christianity has not enriched him, nor does it mean that millions have not found consolation in their faith. But it does mean that in substance, as in the Greek or Roman world, this faith was never able and has never been able to lead its followers to the final consummation that it sought: world peace, world security, and universal enlightenment. These things have not been accomplished, yet we all know that essentially they are part of a natural and proper spiritual achievement. We dream of it, we hope for it, we pray for it, but it does not happen. One of the reasons, of course, why it does not happen is because a sufficient degree of insight has not been conveyed to the believer. The insight has been vested in the faith itself instead of in the hearts of those who seek to follow it. In the Greek mysteries, these great degrees of insight were vested in comparatively small groups of persons who had achieved initiation into the greater mysteries. They possessed an operating key by means of which they could take these principles and put them to work in daily life. The average person lacked this ability. So Neoplatonism, surveying the situation very carefully, came to a conclusion of great profundity and universal unpopularity. And that is that if you want to have this kind of insight, you have to earn it. Now that is one thing that no one has really greatly desired to discover. No one has really wanted to find out that religion was hard work. Now there is a great deal of difference in hard work between the long, quiet, laborious process of becoming and even the dramatic, dynamic experience of martyrdom. It is much easier in many ways to die for a belief than it is to understand that belief. You may also die with tremendous courage, great conviction, and with an absolute dedication. And no one shall doubt the sincerity of the tremendous impulse which has brought with it not only martyrdom, but years of sorrow and burden and humiliation and disgrace. These things we know, but man becoming burdened gains a strange pathos from his burden. Becoming embarrassed with the persecutions and sorrows which are heaped upon him, strangely, he gains patience without understanding. He gains a certain ability to bear upon a large collective concept, but he does not gain this strange facility to take these experiences and use them as a pointed directive to his own unfoldment and release. Therefore, he achieves a certain goodness, but it is not a dynamic goodness. It is not the kind of goodness that changes history. It is not the kind of goodness that makes possible the fulfillment of a great spiritual dispensation. The Neoplatonists took this problem directly in hand, and sometime we must likewise do the same. We have to begin to appreciate the tremendous importance of religious education in the sense that it is not merely a believing, that it is not something that is conferred to us by birth alone, that it is not something that we can receive through the symbolic application of the sacraments, but that spiritual integrity and spiritual enlightenment must arise in the disciplined life of the individual in a kind of consecration which is wonderfully reasonable, wonderfully simple, and constantly penetrating toward the interior parts of beliefs and ideas. Without this, we do not gain the insight which bestows security upon the outer life of the individual. Our present psychological distress throughout the world, with our various phobias and neuroses increasing daily, these are testimonies to the lack of man's internal defense against spiritual ignorance. And without the development of the necessary armament, this ignorance cannot be removed. And someday, if we are not able to demonstrate that our religion has more values than we know, it will become vulnerable to the attacks of humanism, materialism, and other negative forces. Thus, we are now confronted with the problem of seeing how Neoplatonism took hold of the great cycle of classic mythology and attempted to show that it was a veiled scientific account of the regeneration of man. That all religion is merely a picturalization, a revelation in form of that which is essentially formless, but is a way of life peculiarly significant, peculiarly reasonable, absolutely scientific, and demonstrable by those who will take the time and effort to fulfill its normal requirements. Neoplatonism took then the strong and definite stand that religion is not merely a believing. It is a schooling. It is a complete purpose. It is a way of life. It is something that from the cradle to the grave must be cultivated. Cultivated not merely through a series of unfolding acceptances, but cultivated through a series of dynamic adjustments between the individual and the world in which he lives. Although the Neoplatonists are regarded as mystics, they were really among the most practical and reasonable of philosophers. For they alone, perhaps, of all schools, emphasize that your attainment is not by learning, but that learning is merely the instrument of becoming. And learning that does not lead toward becoming, does not impel becoming, and does not create within the individual an uncontrollable enthusiasm to become. If these are not engendered by the natural course of faith, then that faith is inadequate, or at least has been inadequately interpreted. Neoplatonism then simply begins with this problem. No man can be saved by what he knows. This is something which perhaps might seem unusual in a philosophical institution. But Neoplatonism sought to break away from this way of measuring things, by which a certain smugness and contentment arose from the possession of knowledge, that the individual who became knowledge-ridden was by this virtue superior. This the Neoplatonist opposed bitterly. He declared that knowledge, unless it led to a purpose which justified its possession, was a detriment inasmuch as it led the individual to a false sense of his own achievement. The ignorant man is aware that he is ignorant because he can in no way defend his ignorance, nor can he deny that those around him know more. But a man possessing knowledge without the true key to knowledge has also forgotten that he is ignorant. He has come to the conclusion that the kind of knowledge that he possesses is ultimate, that it is solutional, and that he has solved by knowing. And he is oblivious to the fact that having attained knowledge, as we understand the word, he is still subject to the inevitable vicissitudes of life. And like the most ignorant man, he is still born, still suffers, and still dies. And in the midst of his knowledge, can put neither his house nor his life in order. This point is of the greatest significance to the Neoplatonist. That a man can know much and still live badly. That the individual can achieve a degree of knowledge insight, which may cause him to be publicly applauded. Yet at the same time, in his private life, is lonely, frightened, insufficient, frustrated, unadjusted. That such things can exist means, of course, only one of two things. Namely, that knowledge in itself is an illusion. Or second, that the individual who believes that he possesses it does not possess it. Neoplatonism assumes the second position. Namely, that the individual who assumes that he possesses knowledge does not possess it unless this knowledge solves the immediate problems of living. On this grounds, of course, we would find much knowledge vanity, inasmuch as a great part of knowledge today makes no claim to solve personal problems, but perhaps in a large, broad way invites us to assume that ultimately, through knowledge, means may be found to solve large problems. Thus, the actual application is delayed into the future, at a time when the present person will no longer be here to weigh or estimate the consequences. Actually, therefore, Neoplatonism begins by analyzing the nature of knowledge. And this knowledge is recognized as having a certain relationship to final demonstration of itself. In science, certain things must inevitably be demonstrated. And in knowledge, demonstration has been lost, particularly on the religious and philosophical levels. It has been rescued scientifically, and for that reason, much philosophy and religion has moved onto a scientific basis. But the great problem remains that knowledge is merely a kind of skill. Knowledge is to the mind what skill is to the hand. Knowledge is also very largely a development within the sphere of skills. By means of skills, we can do certain things. By means of skills, we become more able to interpret or to express purposes. We have greater proficiency in the finishing and completing of the projects which we undertake. But all of this knowledge skill falls short unless with this knowledge is an adequate incentive by means of which we shall employ skill always for the achievement of an end superior to skill. Knowledge, therefore, as an end is illusion. Knowledge as a means to an end has value. But even this is inadequate unless in man the power of volition, the will, binds this knowledge to its purposes resolutely and permanently, so that there is never a time or a circumstance in which the individual does not recognize the responsibility for the continuous application of knowledge to its reasonable ends, these reasonable ends being the improvement of self and the improvement of society. Wherever knowledge is allowed to remain unused, it turns upon the person who possesses it and changes him from a truth seeker to an arrogant egotist. The tremendous challenge, then, of knowledge is the ability to survive the process of learning, so that the individual, having achieved learning, will not have his incentives destroyed by his own achievement, and will not sacrifice the vitality of his dynamic capacities in the effort to inform or intellectualize his life. If in Neoplatonism, consequently, we are in the presence of this relationship, we know that these people borrowed all of their symbolism from the great religious systems around them. They were among the first, perhaps, to truly and fully experiment with the concept of a psychological universe, a universe in which every so-called fixed substance or element was merely a symbolic reminder of a dynamic, of a force or factor, itself invisible, but more important than the visible structure which depended from it. The universe of the Neoplatonists, therefore, was not a world of elements or a world of godlings, as in the more conservative systems of pagan theology. It was a world of symbols, of processes, of achievements, of attitudes, of relations between things. And in this system, your deities all become embodiments or personifications of attitudes. They become the way we think or feel about something. In this way, we realize that man lives in a world surrounded by attitude stimuli, and that within himself he possesses an almost infinite field of attitudes which can be stimulated and can be brought to the surface by the various processes of living. The Neoplatonist began to contemplate the divine powers of nature as divine dimensions of his own soul. He recognized a principle which we may basically term reason or rationalized intellect. He assigned this reasonable power to the deity Cronus, assuming that in this ancient father god we have the common emblem of father reason, the root and ground of the rational power. And that from this rational power, there suspended another power, which can be regarded as the power of Zeus. This power now being intellectualism, which is a demiurgus, or semi-ruler, a partial god. And in this mental principle, the Neoplatonists recognized a distinct separateness from the rational principle, even as they recognized the difference between intellectual and intelligible principles. About intellectual principles, thinking is possible. About intelligible principles, rationalization is possible. And the Neoplatonists divided between thought and rationalization. The next thing is that they had created a new instrument, which they termed the soul, or the psychic part of man. They did not devise the term, but they devised its peculiar relationship to the whole pattern. And they placed the soul in the relationship to the external life of man, as suspended between the mind and the appetites. The appetites being particularly those phases of elementary function and concept which we associate with the physical requirements of the individual. The psychic life, therefore, was a bridge between body and mind, a bridge across which the individual passed from a state of comparative not knowing to a state of intellectualism. Now, this is not an entirely easy or natural transition to make. But according to the Neoplatonists, this part of man's journey was a collective journey in which the entire motion of society, the cultural life of man, was carrying him along, almost like a ship upon the surface of a heavy current. Regardless of what man tries to do, regardless of his indolence or his industry, regardless of his faith or his lack of faith, man is being moved from a physical to an intellectual life. And this is due to his soul, which is a series of pressures within himself by means of which he is unable to remain in any state indefinitely. His soul moves him by fear, by ambition, by the gratification of his sensory desires, by his instincts, and to a measure by his intuitional overtones. The soul, in other words, is the part of man which will never let him remain as he is today. Even though his soul may apparently lead him into ways of error so that he becomes worse, this increase of his ignorance, presumably, is a dynamic chemistry by which the increase of his knowledge is ultimately inevitable. Consequently, regardless of how actively or passively he accepts life, how much he rejects, how numerous his prejudices and his opinions may be, how bigoted his emotions or his mind, the individual is being moved along inevitably by the total pressure of his kind from the state of total ignorance to the state of intellectual integration. In our way of life, which is nearly 2,000 years later than that of this great transitional period, the intellectual life of man has certainly been strengthened. We perceive also the constant activity around him, the pressures that force him more and more to the state of knowing. I was talking not long ago to a young man who is now in one of our technological institutes learning scientific profession relating to electronics. He explained to me the tremendous increase in the specialization within this field in the last 10 years, that men who were educated 15 years ago in the field now regard themselves as practically obsolete. This young man tells us that it is not only going to be necessary for him to go to school and study for several years yet to come, but that after he graduates, it will probably be necessary for him to spend from 3 to 4 months a year in continuous study for the rest of his career to keep up with the incredible progress that is being made in these fields of specialization. This might actually represent the mounting momentum of intellectualism, whereas the mind must become more and more familiar with a greater diversity of specializations in order to keep pace with the discoveries and with the leading intellects of this time. In this process, this young man is going to have relatively little opportunity or time for reflection. He is going to have almost no incentive whatever towards the release of his own life through anything except the job that he holds and the scientific career which he has accepted. If he is able to manage a fairly effective personal life and have a home as good as that of his neighbor, he is going to do about all that can reasonably be expected of him. Yet this young man himself realizes, even though he is caught in this network, that he is going nowhere. He is going nowhere because even if he keeps up all that he knows for the rest of his life and goes off into his own quiet grave, within 25 years, everything that he has learned will probably be largely changed and modified. And he departs out of this life with a learning which is not only a very little support to him while he lives, but no probable support to him if he has any existence outside of this world whatsoever. In fact, if he gets to the place where the facts are known, his entire education will fall to pieces, because he has only been working with the fringe of facts, which he fully knows. He knows that if he worked at and remained in school all of his time, from now till his 70th year, he would still be only on the fringe of facts. This is a rather frustrating situation, and it reminds us of the same point that the Neoplatonist was pounding on so desperately. Namely, that somewhere in this situation, what we call the intellect, has taken over and mistaken the gratification of its own instincts to be living, to be purpose. And upon the comparison of the lives and characters of persons so dominated, we build our concepts of right and wrong, of ability and debility, of success and failure. It does not occur to us, as it did to these philosophers nearly 2,000 years ago, that perhaps all the world is a failure, and that what we are doing is an endless and eternal compromise from which we see no escape, and from which we gain little true support in anything that is actually necessary to us. With all that we are doing, we are not achieving solution. With greater knowledge than ever before, we live in greater danger than ever before. This means that knowledge is not the answer. This means that the basic weakness of the theory, principle, concept of knowledge has never been adequately corrected. Neoplatonism says there is only one way of achieving this correction, and that is by a series of steps, the first of which is the elevation of man from the state of intellectualism to the state of rationality. Now, rationality is considerably higher than mind, even as mind is higher than appetite. And as an individual in our world realizes gradually through his mind that through the continuous gratification of his appetites alone, he can destroy his economic life, destroy his health, and destroy his social adjustment. And therefore he imposes, reluctantly, but nevertheless resolutely, certain restraints upon his own personal appetites. Failing to do so, he must expect the punishments and penalties of excess. This he realizes, and he tries, at least half-heartedly, to protect his own survival by bringing the mind to bear upon the problems of his impulses and instincts. Plotinus tells us that in the same way, the survival of the intellectual creature depends upon the rational discipline. That the individual cannot do anything that he thinks to do. That he cannot depend upon his thoughts as the absolute and proper guides and rules of his life. He cannot follow his mind any more than he follows his appetites. Nor can he regard a well-filled mind as being any more protective of his ultimate security than a well-filled stomach. Both may have their proper places, but neither the filled mind nor the filled stomach guarantee a happy person. Both of these factors are subject to rationalization. And rationalization is the placing of the total life under the over-concept of the reasonable. In nature, man may not know always that which is true, but he does perceive, at least dimly, that which is reasonable. And he discovers frequently that the reasonable is in conflict with the desirable, in the sense of his ordinary level of thoughts, emotions, and desires. Consequently, the development of a rational life impels the individual toward the accomplishment of rational instruments, where he will never be rational simply by desiring to be. The desire he must have. But this desire, like many desires in life, will mean nothing unless it mainsprings a dynamic determination to achieve this end which is desirable. So Plotinus tells us that the development of man depends upon a series of natural disciplines imposed by society to a certain point, this being the discipline which brings with it ultimate intellectual integration. Then, self-imposed disciplines, which must always be present where the individual desires to transcend the common policy of his time. The moment the individual wishes to be better than those around him, and I do not mean this arrogantly, but in a sincere and natural desire to improve. If he wishes to live better than his times, better than his environment, or better than that standard which is defended by litigation or legation around him, in order to achieve this better standard, it is necessary for him to impose discipline upon himself. There is no one else to do it. And to achieve this end without falling under some fanaticism or some theological discipline which may or may not be suitable or necessary, he must begin the process of self-government. The rational person must begin to live according to the dictates of reason. And reason in this case is much more than thought. Reason is a combination of thought projected through experience toward vision and insight. Reason, then, is actually man's determination from the known, that which is next or remains partly known. It is the thing which causes us today to plan for the future. It is that dimension which indicates to us an achievement yet to be made. And to achieve this, to do that which has not been done, to remain true without the defense and support of society, all this requires a peculiar kind of dedication. The individual may or may not feel the importance of this dedication in terms of immediate utilities. Therefore, he is impelled to it also by considerations larger than those of his daily life. Religion gives him such motivations by reminding him of his moral duties, by reminding him of the divine will and the divine plan for man. And the religious person is impelled toward the cultivation of a higher moral or ethical life by the principles of his faith, which will offer him certain inducements, among these inducements being the protection and presence of divine favor if he abides by those divine laws which transcend his normal instincts or desires. This may in itself be useful. But here he is again trusting his nature to a pressure which Plotinus does not primarily advocate. He can see why and how the religious person might have more inducements to become rational than other persons. But this is not his answer to this problem. The problem of rationality depends for Plotinus upon the Platonic universe, upon the great theological system of the Greeks, namely, actually, that the universe, the gods, creation, all things come to age in man. Man is therefore the hope of ages. Man is the peculiar embodiment, personification of the entire universal rationality. That peculiar power which we call human reason can never be perfected apart from man. This human reason is a phase or form of divine reason. And that kind of divine reason which lies at the root of man can never manifest itself except through man. Consequently, man's growth is God's unfolding. Man's achievement is God's release. Man's attunement to universals is consequently his natural opportunity, his universal responsibility, and his most personal and immediate obligation. All other things are second to man's actual acceptance of the purpose for which he was created. That purpose being that universal reason shall come of age in him. If he fails in this purpose, all other achievements are as nothing. If, however, through a complete and perfect dedication to this purpose, presuming such is possible, man through the attainment of this purpose attains with it all other things that are necessary to him, the individual, therefore, who becomes truly and totally an instrument of the rational principle, in this achievement attains the total integration of himself. There is from that time on no impulse, instinct, or incentive in him to perform such actions as may have detrimental consequences to himself or others. Nor is there any inducement by which he can be moved away from equilibrium into some excess which may be painful to himself or dangerous to others. Thus the person established in rationality is established upon an immovable foundation, a foundation which prohibits and forbids that he shall ever be a menace, a danger, or a hazard to himself or others. The achievement of such a state may naturally and inevitably be regarded as desirable, but with most persons they hope that someone else will get to the position where they will be too wise to injure each other, and that the individual involved can continue in his own ways. It is very hard for man to contemplate the arduous procedure of truly rational development. Yet Plotinus also tells us that this peculiar arduousness with which we have bound the concept and by which we have made discipline the antonym of our own desires, that this entire concept is an illusion, is error. That actually it is far more difficult for us to be unintelligent than it is for us to be illumined. That it is far more arduous for us to strive to continue an inadequate state than it is to relax and permit ourselves to move into adequacy. That actually, the natural motion of existence is the one motion which we can accept without pressure, without hazard, and without conflict. Wherever we are out of tune or out of harmony with universal motion, we are in pain or in sorrow or in stress. Our present state is a proof of non-alignment between man and his own purpose. And the moment man moves into alignment, all friction, all tension or stress, detrimental to his peace of mind and peace of soul, correspondingly diminish with the degree of his adjustment. So Plotinus points out the importance of the rational way of approaching life. Then he takes the great expanded universe of the Greeks, the Gnostics, and the Egyptians, and shows that this universe is a kind of luminous sphere of adjustments by means of which the individual ascends this ladder of the stars by a series of attainments within himself. That the universe is in reality levels and degrees of consciousness, and that man moves through these levels, and that as he ascends, he comes into spheres more compatible than those he leaves behind, and that the natural ascent of man, or the return of the traveler to his own home, is simply the restoration of universality in the consciousness of the individual by a series of disciplines which are referred to by the Neoplatonists as theurgical, or the use of the divine magic. This divine magic is the mysterious, God-given, miraculous faculty in man. It is the fulfillment of the concept which has been held by most religious and philosophical systems without perhaps complete rationalization, namely that there is a power resident in man by means of which all things are possible, and that this power by which all things can be made possible or can be regarded as possible has only one possible nature, and that is that it is all nature, that it is the only power in which all things are possible, and that is the divine power itself. Thus, because man possesses a participation in a natural birthright of divine energy, by this reason, man can attain anything possible to man. And those things possible to man include man's final and complete liberation and re-identification with God. Such achievement is not only possible, but archetypally inevitable. And the great sorrow of man is his struggle against inevitable good. This is his burden, and the terrible problem which he has never been able to solve to his own satisfaction or to the comfort and convenience of those around him. Theurgical discipline begins with the gradual reduction of the quotient of error in the conduct of the individual. As the Greek mysteries pointed out, let no man say he is good who does not act in conformity with the good. This idea that we have, that an individual is good in spite of his mistakes, that he is good although his actions are not good, this concept is erroneous. Also, that an individual whose concepts are good and whose actions are relatively good should be satisfied to continue upon this level of relative good continuously throughout life, this also is not good. Therefore, even attained goodness is in constant mutation, and the individual who in one day has not more of goodness than he possessed the day before is himself failing in some respect. It is not possible to establish a code of good and live by it from the cradle to the grave. Good is an unfolding degree of insight, and growth requires that this growth unfoldment should be continuous, and that each individual surmounts the past with each new day, rising victoriously now over all the yesterdays that went before. The continuance or pushing of error from today into tomorrow without change of its quality or nature cannot be considered to be natural growth, nor can it lead to natural growth. Neoplatonism was not a greatly favored belief simply because it tied religion, philosophy, and science to a process of continuous becoming through disciplined action. A kind of discipline, however, that is almost Zen-like. And there is much in these early Greek and Roman philosophies to indicate Asiatic contact. Because, like Zen, Neoplatonism moved in a kind of mystery. It moved in the mystery of man's relaxing into good. It moved in the mystery of a discipline by which the person achieved all good by gradually separating his consciousness from that which was not good. Not through the victory by self-effort of man over every frailty of his own flesh, but the ability to transcend certain attitudes and move into others, and by the changing of one attitude, changing 100 habits all at once. That is the difference between Platonism and Aristotelianism primarily. Aristotle, when he went after something, tried to get the bug off of every leaf. He was going to save the tree a leaf at a time. Plato took the attitude that if you gave the tree good food in the roots, the chances are the tree would be strong enough to get rid of the bugs.